You are now listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC, so if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
Fill it up! I dare you, pussies!
Get ready for the social hour!
Live from Dice World Studios in San Antonio, Texas, this is The Social Hour. On today's show, comic book creator Ed Davis. And now your host, about to do an ad for American Eagle for a genetic propensity for alcoholism genes, Deese Casillas.
Malam Keen, everyone, welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Deese. What is up, guys? Thanks for coming back, hanging around for another episode. We appreciate you being here. As usual, if you like what you hear, you like what you see, if you're watching it, tell a friend, let someone know, rate us, review us on your favorite pod, catching, casting, listening place. You do that. That's the best. That helps us a lot. And tell a friend. That's what we need. Word of mouth is the best way to spread this. So we appreciate it, guys. And real quickly, before we get into it with our guest this week, I will be at the NTX Comic Show this Saturday, August 2nd in Frisco, Texas. Jim Lee is going to be there. I will also be there. Don't spend all your money at the Jim Lee table. Come see me, but I'm excited to get a chance to meet him also and get some stuff signed by him. That's going to be a fun show. And then August 9th, I will be in Dallas at the Texas Latino Comic Convention. That is in Dallas, Texas. That's going to be a lot of fun also. And then the 16th and 17th, I will be at the Powerhouse Convention in Tri-Cities, Washington, Pasco, Washington, to be specific. And then a lot more shows all through September also. Del Rio Comic Con, I'll be a featured guest there. That's the 6th and 7th. And more. Check the dates at inferno.earth and on our Instagram, inferno.earth. Give us a follow there if you haven't already. And then as for comedy, go to deesecomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network, live shows, live dates. I am going to be doing a ton of live dates this month. I am looking forward to that. We have the THC show coming back to Upstage Comedy Lounge in San Antonio, Texas on August 10th. Get your tickets for that. Those sell out fast. I will be in Pasco, Richland, Washington on August 13th. I will be in Kennewick, Washington on August 14th. Yakima, Washington, the 15th and 16th. I will be, I don't remember where, but somewhere on the 17th in Washington. And then also Oak Harbor, Renton, Rockport, a bunch of other places around Washington. So get those tickets. Follow me on deese.comedy on Instagram for all kinds of dates all through the Northwest. Looking forward to being back up there, slanging some jokes to you. And that's it, guys. Go to the social media. That's why we do it. Find out where we're at and come check it out. And other than that, we are going to get into it with our guest today, guys. He is the host of the Saturday Morning Comic Talk and the First Impressions podcast, and the creator of the Immortal Era comic book. Please welcome to the show, Ed Davis. What's up, Ed? How you doing, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being here. I appreciate you coming on. Excited for you. Congrats, the Kickstarter. You got about 19 days left, but you already made it to the goal. That's always a good feeling.
Oh, that it's always the huge relief, because you're kind of trudging along and trying to get there, and then we had an amazing weekend with it. And it's funny, because it was the weekend where I wasn't babysitting it, because I was at San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh yeah.
And I was not focused on the Kickstarters, like, you know what, let it do its thing, I'll share it a couple times. And then it just kind of moved and moved and moved, and other people were sharing it and moving it along. And then next thing you know, I woke up Sunday morning, saw it was funded. I'm like, wow. Without worrying about it, without all the normal stress, it got funded. So now it's just building, getting those stretch goals and things like that. But it's such a relief to hit that minimum funding goal, because the rest is gravy. Once you've got that,
yeah.
If it stopped now, I'm content. I mean, obviously you don't want it to stop, but you know that if it did, if for some strange reason people were just done with it, like, all right, we're satisfied, we don't need to back it, you know that you've met your goal. You know that now, for me, I can afford to pay for the printing. And that's mainly what the Kickstarter goes for, is just getting those printing costs recuperated.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's so do you write and draw this then?
I don't. I do the writing. Okay. And then I have an artist. He's actually based in Brazil, and he's been with me since issue one. He writes my second series, Corruptor, as well. So he's Cesar Oliveira, and he's been with me forever. So it's great to work with an artist that knows kind of what to do. In the beginning, of course, it's a lot slower. You have to get exactly how you want him to work. But now he can trust his own instincts and know that 9 times out of 10, I'm going to go with what he says. Because, you know, I have a writer's eye. He has an artist's eye. So it's good to have him in there kind of saying it might be a little visually more interesting if we add a panel here or subtract a panel here. So
yeah,
having someone that you've worked closely with for that many years is always a perk.
Yeah, I thought you wrote. I mean, well, so the Kickstarter, you gotta pay your artist too. Then, I mean, it's not just the printing. That's the man. The whole thing is not. It's not a cheap endeavor, but man,
if
you can get it to work and you know, find that those people out there, man, it can. It's not as hard to make it work as people think. At least, you know, from a perspective of, you know, not losing a ton of money. You can do it and still like break even, or at least make some money pretty easily if you do it right, I think.
Yeah, and for me, the Kickstarter's funding goal is always enough to pay for the printing. What you get above that helps with the artist fees. And then of course cons are the big thing. The cons that you do where you're selling the book once you've paid to have it printed, that's what helps recoup those art fees. And then the good thing is, once I hit issue 12, we take it to trade. At that point, I'm not recouping any more art fees. Those are done.
Right.
Now it's literally just the printing fees, and trades move. I mean, that's the thing I noticed, is as soon as I put that first trade on the table, the people gobble them up, because you get those people, they will never buy a floppy. They have that wait for the trade mentality, whether you're Marvel, you're DC, your Image, or just some indie. They want a trade. They want it up on their bookshelf. They don't have long boxes upon long boxes sitting in their garage or like you have behind you. Their collection is either on the bookshelf or even the digital collectors.
And yeah,
that's what they have. They have a hard drive and that's their collection.
Well, do you think that the trade paperback, a big part of it is like the Netflix thing, where people want to binge it? They don't want to wait, especially like an indie book. This is the hard part, because like an indie book is very, very, very few self-funded indie books are coming out once a month, if any. Yeah. You know, they're probably, probably every couple months at best. So, you know, like we'll say every 3 months is probably a pretty good clip for an indie book. So it's easy to lose people, or for people to be like, well, I don't want to wait 3 months, you know? Mm-hmm. So at least with, if they're reading something from Marvel, it's coming out, you know, every 4 weeks they're getting a new copy. Sometimes it's 18 times a year, you know, for some of the bigger books. So, where with a trade paperback, they can binge it.
Yeah. And I think it is that. I think the way people consume media has changed.
Yeah.
Where when I was growing up, probably when you were growing up, you waited for every month when that new issue of whatever the series you loved was coming out. I had the subscriptions to some of them. So I know, you know, you go to the back of the comic book, you'd cut out the little subscription thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'd get that. So I had Sandman, Preacher, Why the Last Man. I had the monthly subscription, so you'd wait for it to show up in your mailbox. But now they'll wait, like you said, they want to binge it all at once, so they're waiting for that trade to come out. And I tell people it's going to be probably 3 years for each trade, but they said I don't care. I'll wait. And then they'll reread the first trade and read the second one, and then they'll be like, okay, see you in 3 years. I'll buy it when you're ready.
We're good to go. I don't think, you know, people who are considerably younger, I don't think they understand that, you know, like when I got Disney Plus, I was so excited to watch the original X-Men animated series in its entirety, right? And my girlfriend was so confused because she knows I'm such an X-Men fan. She's like, this was around when you were a kid. Haven't you seen all these? And I said, well, no, because if you missed an episode, you just maybe missed it forever. Like you may not catch it in reruns. You may not be there the right Saturday. You may never see it. There wasn't an option to go watch it digitally or to be like, I would like to request this episode, you know?
Yeah.
It's just whatever they were playing. So, you know, it wasn't quite, that's why such things were like appointment viewing, because if you missed it, you may never see it.
Yeah, reruns didn't just go sequential. They didn't think, okay, the season is ended, let's start again on episode one from the season. No, they just threw shit out there. It was, you know, here, we're going to start with episode 9 on our reruns. And you're like, damn it, I need episode 7.
Yeah.
You would, I mean, the thing is, you could do the wait and then buy the VHSs. That's what I had to do with a lot of them. Like, all right, I'm going to buy the VHSs. And each video cassette gave you 4 episodes. So to get a full season of X-Men, that was costly, because I mean, I was in college at that time. I didn't have money to throw around because I wanted to finally catch up. I mean, it's so easy, and you get them all at once for so many of the shows. You don't have to sit and wait. And like you said, if you miss one, you may never get it. And X-Men was one of those shows that ran full story arcs. It wasn't just, you know, villain of the week. Because if I missed an episode of Transformers, I could never see it, and it wouldn't matter, because it wasn't linear storytelling. Once in a while, they do a 2 or 3-parter. But if they did something like that with Transformers or Masters of the Universe, those ones, they would air all 3 in one shot several times throughout, because that was a rarity for them. But with X-Men, it was always running sequentially. And if you missed it, you missed it.
Yeah, it was integral for the whole story to read. Like, each season was very much its own self-contained arc, you know. Well, the later seasons got a little squirrely, but the first few, you know, when they shipped it off to the Philippines and were just like, make it cheaper, make it faster. Then it got a little weird. But it very much was necessary to see it all. Yeah, I mean, now it's, I think people really do... It's such a battle in comics in general, because first of all, you know, we're losing people who read comic books, you know, I mean, in a generation, 90% of comic book readers are going to be dead.
They moved on to manga. So it's how do you compete with kids that don't want to read a Western comic book?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Which is interesting. I've got a couple theories about this, because I mean, not only just like, obviously it proliferated the market so well and really kind of overtook it, but I mean, I think it was kind of the maybe X-Men Philippines thing, like cheaper, faster to make. So they, you know, a lot of these syndication channels were buying it to, because it was cheaper than making their own thing, you know?
Yeah.
But also I think there's a little bit of like anti-establishment, but anti-status quo of like, we want to be in this thing that's different. Like, we want this other culture's art, not American art. You know, it's like, you got, because every generation's got to like push back against whatever the norm is a little bit, right?
Yeah.
So
they're punk rock of reading.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. So, yeah. So I think that's a big part of it, too, that we, you know, we lost that battle as American art, comics, cartoons, because of, not solely, but partly because of that.
Yeah.
No. But yeah, it's such a battle to get those readers to come to you and then get them to stay with the distractions around these days.
Yeah, especially because it takes patience. Ooh. If you want to hook an indie comic reader, we aren't going to give you instant gratification. It's going to be a wait.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's when I try to approach the younger, when you see, you know, the high school kids, the early college kids, and they come up to your table and you're trying to sell them on a story, but also sell them on, the waiting. Like, it's worth the wait.
Yeah.
It's a difficult task because the majority of people that come up to my table, they're my age, they're your age.
Yeah.
They're old readers. They grew up going to 7-Eleven to get their comic books, you know, reading monthly and getting that. And the newer readers, they're growing up on webtoons, they're growing up on manga,
yeah.
And they've grown up with a whole different look, and we still want to bring them in because I've had younger kids come up, read the book and love it, and the characters resonate, the story resonates, but to get them to commit is the hardest thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's just a plethora of entertainment at their fingertips all the time. It's hard to, you know, you're a drop in the bucket. To get someone to commit to something like that is tough, you know, especially in a market where dollars are a commodity, how much money you have, where you can spend it, and that you can... I mean, but YouTube's free, so, you know, everyone's got a phone with YouTube on it pretty much, or a computer, so it's a tough battle. So with your book, Immortal Era, when did you start this? You're at issue 11, so how long have you been working on this?
Issue 1 came out in August of 2019.
Okay.
Yeah, and then of course we had to get through 2020, which was crazy because all of a sudden my artist couldn't get the paper because he does traditional paper and ink.
Oh gosh, yeah.
So all of a sudden he says, I can't even get the paper because the store that sold the paper is closed down. I can mail order it, but Brazil is a fucking wasteland in their postal system. I have tried to mail things to them. And I was doing a thing with issue 1 where I got all the different artists to sign it. So I had to mail it to Italy, to my colorist, and then she mailed it to Brazil. And next thing you know, I'm getting an email from Brazil. Oh, we have your package, but we're going to put it into salvage if you don't send us $300. And then like, getting it out, the like, same thing.
Like a ransom deal with your package.
It really was. We have your books. If you want to see them again, send us $300.
That's crazy. That does sound like Brazil, though. It is funny. So my artist also lives in Brazil, and I sent him some copies of the book just for him to have, right? And my God, is it expensive to ship anything to Brazil.
Yeah, it is.
So I was like, I think I included, like, I just doubled the amount of books I sent him. Cause I'm like, it's cheap, you know, it only cost me a couple bucks more if I put some more books in, but I don't want to have to do this twice. Cause you know, I might as well just do it the one time and spend $5 more than do it twice and have to spend an extra 60 or whatever it was just to send a handful of books down there. So, you know, but to be fair, also, I think we're like very spoiled because, you know, it seems expensive to ship things in America, but like I don't know what the cost of a stamp is now. I don't know, 52 cents. Whatever. It is.
I'm not sure.
It's less than a dollar, right? It's less than a dollar. If someone came to you, Ed, and was like, okay, so this is a letter for my granny who lives in Pennsylvania. It's not going to be easy to find her. She lives in a very rural area. So I want you to take this letter and I want you to fly it all the way to Pennsylvania. Then I want you to get into an electric go-kart and drive it down her dirt road and deliver it to her door. And you're like, well, how much are you going to pay me? Like 52 cents. That's what I'm gonna, like, you know, so we do have a little bit of we are spoiled in a sense when it comes to our our postal system.
I guess so. When you think for under a dollar, you can get it to the sticks. I mean, the most desolate area, and it's going to show up in their mailbox. Might take a little while, but it's going to get there, and you haven't even dropped a full dollar. So,
right. You're like, what if it's raining or sleeting or snowing? Doesn't stop us.
You'll get it there. It might have a little wet on it, but your granny will get the letter.
It's literally in our motto. So give us the, for the listeners who aren't familiar with your book, give them the kind of elevator pitch for the book.
All right, so Immortal Era, it's a story that takes place 200 years in the future in a world where everyone has gained immortality. So in this world, everyone is immortal, but no one has any kind of powers or abilities, so they can still age, they still get sick. One of my main characters in the story is just a decapitated head, and he keeps living on. So it centers on a group of heroes that have been forced to live underground. So in this world, it's overpopulated. There's no natural resources, so you kind of get a split world where half the population gets to live up in these big crumbling cities, but they're considered the legal citizens. The rest are living underground, and there's a group of these underground dwellers that are trying to find relics that would explain exactly why people became immortal, because their goal is to restore the natural life cycle and save humanity by killing them.
Interesting. So they want to end it. They think everyone should be dead.
They want them. They, of course, I say in this story, they want everyone to die of natural causes eventually.
Got
but
it.
Not to be stuck living and living, because we see, you know, once you reach a certain age, you're not going to be able to move. Your mobility is going to be gone. You're going to most likely be completely senile, barely able to think for yourself, but you're going to keep living through it. You could get cancer. You're going to keep living with that cancer. It's never going to kill you, but you're going to feel that pain every single day.
So they still age and age drastically. So it's people like 500 years old and just decayed little mummies, but still alive.
Still alive, yeah. And in this world, I think the oldest person you would be able to find would be about 300 years old, because immortality has existed for 200 years. So it all starts in the year 2000 on the millennium. And that's actually when I started writing the book. It was when all the Y2K hysteria was going on. It goes all the way back. My first notes for the book go all the way back to 1998. And when I really started seriously writing it, it was going to be a novel. And it all starts in the year 2000. And I thought, well, what if all this Y2K hysteria was real, but it was way worse than anyone ever predicted?
Yeah.
So we thought, oh, the computers are going to go down and, you know, planes are going to fall from the sky and people are going to, you know, all the financial institutions are going to go bankrupt and lose all your records. And instead, everyone gains immortality. And first we think, amazing, that's what we want. We can live forever. And then you see, you know, the first opening pages of the book take place in a hospital with all of these car crash and shooting victims that should be dead, but they're just living through it. And they're just screaming in pain, and they're going to be stuck that way for an eternity.
Damn, that's interesting. So what do you have an end game for it? Is this a finite amount of issues?
My goal is somewhere around 24 issues.
Okay.
It might end up going about 28, but I'm writing them. I kind of write each story arc in 6-issue story arcs, because it works well for the trade collecting and everything. And it also kind of lets me map everything out. So I think it might take about 28. So we'd get 4 6-issue ones and then a 4-issue one to close everything out. But when I started writing the book, I actually started with the last pages of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the ending before I wrote the beginning, because I want to know exactly where everything needs to go. And now, when I started it as a novel, it was a first-person novel written from one of my characters' point of view. Well, now, as a comic book, you have to branch it out. You have to expand the other characters a lot more. So I've also written the final fate, and in some cases, the final line that every character is going to have.
Interesting.
So I kind of know where it needs to get, and now it's just pushing it to that end.
Yeah. I think this is one of the things I like the most, maybe not the most, but maybe, about indie comics. And this is not indicative of all of them, but I think a lot of them are this way, is that there's a finality to them, which I think is really lost. I mean, as much as I love, you know, I'm an X-Men nut, grew up on the X-Men, love it, have all the issues, still get them, although I don't enjoy them that much anymore. I just get them out of habit. But it's like, there's an interesting concept to having this thing go on in perpetuity. But it also eventually kind of becomes like a caricature and a bastardization, and it's eventually going to become something you hate, and it maybe maybe something you love again. But there's going to be like mischaracterizations and misrepresentations, and it's just impossible not to when it goes on and for 60, 80 years.
Yeah. How many stories do you have to tell about that one character?
And how many creators?
You can add people to the family and everything. Yeah, we still get good Spider-Man or Batman stories or X-Men stories, but there's a lot of bad ones that have also come in between. So I think with my storytelling, I was influenced more by what was going on in Vertigo, because those were the first comic books. I mean, I loved the superhero stuff growing up, obviously. Spider-Man was the first comic that got me hooked. Batman, when it came out in 89, made me want to go back and reread Batman books. But it was when I discovered Sandman, when I discovered Preacher, when I discovered those kind of stories and realized they're finite. They have a story to tell. And when it's done, it's done.
Right.
And I loved that idea of, okay, they're not just going to spin their wheels for years and years and years. Even if it's their number one selling book, the ending has to get there. There's a beginning, there's a middle and an end. And it's truly a graphic novel because it's written in the way of a novel where it has a definitive end that once it's there, and maybe you get a little flashback, you know, issue that's thrown out there here and there. But in the story doesn't change. The ending doesn't change. And that's what influenced my creation of Immortal Era, was those Vertigo books that I was reading in the late 90s.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it just drives, I think it drives the story so much better and makes the story so much weightier and important and interesting, because, you know, it's like, I don't know, nobody cares about someone dying in a comic book now, because you're like, yeah, they'll be back.
Maybe not today, no one really dies.
Maybe not tomorrow. Maybe it'll be 8 years, but they'll be back, you know? Whereas if you have a 24-issue storyline and somebody dies in issue 18, you're like, a good chance they might not be back. That might be the end of that person.
The stakes are real.
Right.
So it's not, okay, they'll bring him back. Now it's, a modified version until it's just exactly what it was before. Kind of like the Superman death issue when people were losing their shit. I remember the madness, and non-comic readers were rushing out because they had to have this. This is the biggest moment in comics. Superman is dead. And I said, he won't stay dead. No, it's dead. I heard it on the news.
Yeah.
And then it's, oh no, he's back. He's resurrected. Batman got his back broken. Oh, no, never mind. It's fixed.
Yeah, so he's back.
Nothing really sticks, because these characters are their bread and butter, and they can't afford to have DC Comics without an ongoing Superman title.
Right. Yeah. 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 And it's just, it's just such a different approach to it. And part of me is like, yeah, I get that. But also part of me is like, I don't know, I, as a creator too, and you tell me if this is the same for you, you think about the next thing so much, like, oh, I want to write the next thing, which is very different from the thing I'm writing now, because I want to show that this breadth of storytelling from a different angle, a different, point of view character, a different setting, a different vibe completely. Because even as a creator, it's like, you just want to do different things.
Yeah, that's something I'm working with now, is to write a few stories that are completely different. And my other book, Corruptor, I set it in a shared universe. So it's got a lot of Immortal Era vibes with it. The next one that's going to be coming out in October is a complete departure, because I needed a complete departure. I'd want to keep building this, huge shared universe, which is fun in its own way, but you want to show I have something else.
Yeah.
Writing stories for the Cthulhu anthology was a fun practice as well, because you have to practice constraint. Right now, if I need an extra few pages for my issue, I add a few pages. 24 is not going to quite cut it. I need to make it 28. But when you're hired by someone else to write a story, you got 8 pages.
Yeah.
You can't say, hey man, can I have 10? No, you got 8. You're getting paid for 8. We don't have the space to give you 10. Figure it out.
Right.
And it's a good practice. And I tell any writer out there, practice writing short when you have to write short, and following the rules that someone else gives you. Because when you're indie publishing, you're writing your own rules.
Yeah.
You have to follow the rules of comic books, obviously, but how many pages, that's up to you. If you want a little more dialogue than is normally in a comic book, then you do it.
Yeah.
And you have all the powers because you're kind of controlling your own publishing. But when you're publishing for somebody else and you're given 8 pages and you need to tell a tight, coherent story, it's a new challenge and it's fun. I had a lot of fun doing that. I wrote 3 stories for the Cthulhu Invades fairy tale series. And right now, volume 2 of that is on Kickstarter. So I have a story in that, as well as the Immortal Era one going on Kickstarter right now. And then my story after this is a one-shot horror story. I thought, I don't want to write a series. This, I just want to make one cool 28-page story, and that's the end of that. So yeah. Writing that was fun as well. So it's kind of like, can I do an issue 2? I leave it open for that, but it's not a to-be-continued kind of thing. It's kind of the story ends, and I wrote it that with that particular story. I wrote it when I was in hospital waiting rooms. I was having all kinds of issues with my eyes, and I had spent one day where I was in a waiting room, different waiting rooms. I got shuffled from one hospital to the next for a total of 17 hours.
Jeez.
And this story kind of birthed out of the bad headspace that I was in. But I thought, you know, I'm going to make it work for me. I can write a really cool and dark story, but I don't want to write an issue 2 because I don't want to be stuck in that headspace again.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it's just, you know, what's happening in that moment, in that, you know, mm-hmm. you take advantage of it, capture it, and then, you know, that's gone. And the next thing that comes along is, yeah, it's the muse is a weird thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's like a, it's almost like a living thing that I think mm-hmm. it's more alive than we give it credit for, you know, in a weird abstract way. So, mm-hmm. So what do you, you know, once the, how, what's the timeline? I mean, what do you predict to get this 25 or 28 issues out and then, be able to move on to the next thing?
I do my, best case scenario is about 3 issues a year.
Okay.
That's what I'm able to do. And then you figure that also moves into a trade every few years. So yeah. You figure, all right, every two years you get a new trade. So that's kind of my goal. And what I'll do is when the trade comes out, last time I put the volume 1 out, I also did issue 7 at the same time. So this time I'll do volume 2 and also issue 13. So mm-hmm. for those who don't care about the trade, my floppy readers, it's like, here you go. You don't have to wait because I'm putting out the trade. You get, you know, for the trade people that have been waiting, you can snatch that up. And for the floppy people that want to just keep moving with the story, they have that. So, I mean, I guess it means it's going to be 3 or 4 years before I'm finished. But what I've done in the meantime is I'm actually releasing the other stuff. I'm not just sticking with Immortal Era. I'm doing the new book, the one-shot Floaters. That'll come out in October. I have one that's Karen Slayers. That one will be out in probably February or March of next year. So I kind of give you your 3 issues of Immortal Era a year and then one other book that's something else. So it makes it so for me, it just gets my mind into different places where yeah. Immortal Era is frozen and writer's block is going hard. I can work on something else.
Is that due to just the workflow of your artist not being able to? Because I mean, I assume you could commit that time to more issues of Immortal Era, but is it just uh-huh. his ability to make, you know, not to be able to do more books in a year? Or
honestly, I think he would go faster. It comes down more to the finances. And I can, if I'm doing a like the Floaters book, it's more of a side book, I'm not in the same race to get it done. And I can take 6 months over time to pay the artist slowly.
Okay. And so you're not, are you not running Kickstarters for those then?
I will be, but those ones, because it's not established, you don't have the same core audience. A lot of your audience will follow you to whatever you do.
Sure, sure.
And then some are like, I like post-apocalyptic stories, but right. I'm not really into horror. And then my corruptor story, I mean, the people who are religious that read Immortal Era, they will not touch that book because, you know, you got a devil on the cover and it's basically a mafia hitman recruited by the devil to corrupt souls. and bring them to hell before everyone gains immortality. So that's why how it kind of connects to Immortal Era. But the religious ones that read Immortal Era, they're like, okay, never mind. You know, tell me when the next Immortal Era is coming out. I don't feel like being damned by my God, so I'm going to skip the Corruptor series.
That is funny, because I was at a convention a couple weeks back, and I was kind of up in Northeast Texas, which is, you know, along the Bible Belt, and it's smaller town and smaller convention. And it was fine, but like I realized very quickly that I'm pitching a book about suicide to a lot of really religious people, and I'm like, this is not the audience for this. For this,
you missed your mark with that.
Yeah,
con.
I had to like readjust how I was explaining it to people. I'm like, I think I need to change up the verbiage of my pitch on this at the moment. So it was like, it's about a guy struggling to find redemption in a world that's corrupted around, you know, or something. Whatever I said.
Yeah, so, and I've done that too. I've revised my pitch, but then. My backdrop is a big devil holding the shoulders of the mobster. So I was like, I can adjust my pitch all I want, but you got the devil and he's surrounded by a bunch of demons. And it's like, okay, pitch all you want, but that devil tells the whole story.
Yeah, what's up with that thing? Oh, that's somebody else's.
And I said, in the book, they're not called the devil. They're not called, you know, God. It's the boss. That's the devil. And God is the big guy. So everything's kind of different mob names. And I try to tell them, you know, in the end, it's going to be a redemption story. You just gotta wait for it, but they don't want to wait for it. But then you take that same book to a horror con, and that's the one that's moving off the table.
Yeah. It, you know, you start to find those pockets where you can figure out what's better where. It's interesting that way. We mentioned a second ago, you know, where people follow artists and creators. What do you think about that? Because I'm always like, writers that I like, I will pick up anything they produce and give it a shot. Whereas like, you know, I think we're both very aware, and probably a lot of listeners too, that not everyone does that. They'll look and be like, that doesn't look like it's for me. And I'm like, I don't know. If it's a writer I like, I'm like, I'll give them a lot of rope. On any genre, you know, I'm not stuck in a genre by any means. I'm a story guy, not a genre guy. Like put anything in any genre, just tell me a good story, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm like that as well. If I have an author I love, I'm going to buy their work when it comes out. If they decide, all right, they're going to do a romance, I'll give it a shot. Cause if I trust their writing, I know they're going to do something interesting.
Yeah.
And that, you know, trust their process. But yeah, there's a lot of people that won't. They say, oh, I don't read horror, so I'm not going to buy your horror one shot. Yeah. Or I don't read, you know, things that have any kind of biblical references. And not that I do. I mean, I kind of take heaven and hell and put them all into mafia terms.
Right.
And someone even told me, I was reluctant to buy it, but I like you as a writer, so I gave it a shot and realized, okay, I'm not coming out here and shitting on the Bible. I'm not here to do that. I'm not here to insult anyone's religion or to promote anyone's religion. I'm telling the story in its own bubble of, you know, kind of how the mob, he thinks he's leaving Earth and things are going to be different, but he just falls into the same patterns he did when he was alive. And the boss is still the boss. And if you don't do what he says, you're going to face some consequences. So kind of turning that world into a more mystical world, but people see that big devil and that's the end of that. And then the same people will be saying, oh, but I love demon slayers. Like, really? Demons in the fucking title. And you're gonna come in with your cross holding a copy of Demon Slayers and tell me you won't read that because the devil on it?
Yeah, pick a lane, man.
Yeah, exactly.
It is interesting how fickle people are, the way they pick and choose kind of what they will you know, what'll kind of what they clutch their pearls about and what they won't, you know, and especially when it comes to art, because I mean, I guess it's a little different. I have a slightly different outlook because I have zero sacred cows. I don't have anything I hold sacred enough that you could truly ever offend me. I have things I care about, but if you don't agree, you don't like it, I don't care. I don't care. So it's just, but people get really, you know, like religious people say, yeah, even if you are religious, like I'm not, we're using these as abstract avatars to tell a bigger story. You know, you could look at this, you know, you could look at Star Wars and pull religious annotations out of it that you could, if we really want to dissect this, but you know, how far down do you want to get into the minutia about it?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at some of the criticism of the very first Superman in 78, they said, oh, they're making him Jesus. And there were religious groups that were banning and, you know, telling people to boycott the movie. And now they look at it as like, that was the good entertainment. That's when things were good.
Wholesome.
And wholesome. And yet in real time, they were angered and they were freaking out and they were boycotting theaters and looking at it as it's a Jesus allegory. So, you know, everything in time offends somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like I always say, a Clockwork Orange is my favorite film of all time. And the book is fantastic also, by Anthony Burgess. And, you know, people, I've tried to show the movie to people because they love it so much. They're like, oh, you love it, I'll watch it. And then they watch it like, ugh, you know, like, it's so dark. It's so this, it's so that. And I go, yeah, but all that has a purpose.
Like, yeah.
It's not gratuitous to be gratuitous. All that is to push the story about social decay and desensitization and how we are ruining society. We're being worse to each other and distant. And this is the potential future if we keep going down this path. Because, like, I'm not sure how familiar you are with it, but the author, Anthony Burgess, he actually wrote the book because his wife was raped in England where they lived. She was sexually assaulted, and then he, in this like grief, this art sprang from it. And if you know if you remember the book or the movie, you know, Alex and the Droogs, they break into the author's house and rape his wife, and like, so I mean, he's like this nepenthe of getting this out through art, and you're like, no, this is catharsis as well as a warning, you know. And people just look at it and they go, oh, it's dark. It's evil. There's violence. You're like, nah, maybe you're just too dumb for this. I don't know.
Yeah. And you can never assume your audience knows anything and they're just going to judge it on the surface level.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. That is tough. Cause I'm such a like, no, there's more. What is this? If it has a purpose, you can do anything if there's purpose, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I gotta ask, because you mentioned the old Superman movie, did you see the new one yet?
I did.
What'd you think?
I thought it was enjoyable on kind of a Saturday morning cartoon level, where to me it felt like almost like pulling the old Superman animated series and putting it up on the screen. And for that part, I enjoyed it. I mean, it wasn't deep. It wasn't thought-provoking.
Yeah.
But as for pulling the Saturday morning cartoon or the comic book and just slapping it on the screen, I thought it was really successful.
Yeah, kind of like there was definitely like some Silver Age-y vibes, which was interesting. I will say, like, I really appreciate that James Gunn picked a unique tone that they've never done for the movies before, because that's never been done. You can do the gritty Superman, you can do the you know, kind of the, I guess, more traditional Superman, but he did his own take, so you're like, okay, it's at least different. And then people are mad because it's not the old, it's not what they expect. But when it's what they expect, they also get mad, and
you can't win, because then you look at, I mean, I think the one that was universally disliked would be the Superman Returns, because it was going for too reverent. Okay, he's, you know, the great Superman and he's returned, and it just ended up being a boring movie.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And then you got the Zack Snyder one, and it's too dark. So you kind of got, you don't want to just stick with the boring. We know the origin. Don't tell it again.
Right.
And it just kind of dropped you into an adventure. Like, okay, here's a four-part story arc from the animated series, and throw it up there, and some of the other DC characters drop in there as they would do. And yeah, I just thought it was fun. It wasn't high art, but it was exactly what a comic book movie needed to be for DC, because they needed to reset the kind of that dark, grim tone that the Snyderverse created.
Yeah. It was, I will say that a lot of there were too many ancillary characters that weren't needed, that like really, you know, like the cat character, even Perry White really only had like lines at the end. You're like, we never really needed him. And also it was kind of one of those things where there were too many characters that were caricatures.
You know?
Like Lex Luthor, or some of the Lex Luthor's cronies were like two weird characters, cat, the Lex Luthor's girlfriend, Perry White. Yeah. They're too like over the top, where you're like, all right, we don't need, this is a little bit of like too, why are all these people so wacky?
And that's why it feels like animation writing to me.
Yeah.
That's why it feels like Saturday morning cartoon writing and not necessarily cinematic.
Right.
And I think that's its greatest strength and weakness, is that it's written like a Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah, yeah. What about FF? Did you see that?
I haven't seen that. It dropped when I was at Comic-Con.
Oh,
so it's
kind
of, the weekend is so busy, so I'm probably going to go see that one. I'm thinking probably Wednesday night.
Okay.
So that's kind of in the plans to go catch that one when we get all the family together to go see it. So have you seen that one yet?
I did, yeah. I did, so... I won't say anything, because I don't want to spoil anything for you. I will say it's worth seeing. I think it was, you know, so
okay.
I don't think you'll walk out mad. You know, but yeah.
So. It's not Quantumania. I'm not going to want my money back.
No, it's not Quantumania. I mean, and again, I think they also did one thing that, like Superman, where they went for a really unique aesthetic and tone, which I applaud. You know, that is like at least a change of pace for the
status
quo.
And Marvel needs something, because they've become so formulaic, and they need to kind of throw something new and not just, oh, look, Robert Downey Jr., you like him, he's back. I mean, that's their desperation. And Fantastic Four can give them kind of new life, because everything else, I think they've done two this year, right? Was it the Captain America and Thunderbolts? Neither one set the world on fire.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched a Bolt. They were fine. They were entertaining.
Yeah.
But they weren't groundbreaking. They were just kind of, all right, more paint by numbers with Marvel.
Yeah. It's just a lot of movies that I don't feel I'd ever need to watch again.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I wasn't mad. I saw that. That was fine. It was 2 hours of just kind of dumb fun. And then I probably will never think about it again.
Yeah. It didn't move you. It entertained you enough, but Marvel needs to get out of the entertaining you enough category. And I guess Fantastic Four is kind of their last, besides X-Men, which, you know, will eventually get rebooted into their universe. Those are their last big guns. And those need to be successful, or they're desperate, because Thunderbolts, that's not a big gun, you know, that Captain America isn't one of their big guns. So I mean, I guess he was, but now when you have the new Captain America, it's not the same tier. So they have to look at it like, okay, these are more of our B ones, almost ones that they could have put on TV and it would have been fine. They could have thrown them on Disney Plus,
right,
and that would have been just as good.
Yeah, because I mean, if you're not a big comic fan, nobody even knows what the hell the Thunderbolts are, and they've been such an inconsistent book over the years as to what they are, and then you know, they do the marketing trick of, oh well, they're actually the new Avengers, and you're like, okay, well, this kind of was a weird kind of bait and switch that they did. Marvel's got to figure something out. They'll get there.
I'm sure they will. They got they got enough money, but I think throwing out, like, doing the whole Kang thing and just deciding, nope, never mind.
Yeah.
That's a bad look. Whether, you know, you can talk about the actor all you want, but all you need to do is just, oh, here's a variant who's come in the universe and boom, okay, problem solved, you know, keep the storyline going. But then they saw people didn't like it, so they just abandoned it. And that's not the way to do it. That's DC's way of doing things. And
yeah,
we saw how well that worked out for them.
Well, that is one of the weird things is, like, I assume they'll never go back to that storyline. I have to assume they'll never touch it again. Because why would you, you know? But it's like, now you just built all that up, based so many movies around it, and, you know, credit scenes of this arena of a bazillion Kangs all yelling, and this is going to happen. And then all of a sudden, like, don't worry about what they're doing out there.
And you see a bazillion Kangs, all right, one looks different. And that, you know, the main Kang, he's dead. Now we have the variant, and he's going to take over. All right, problem solved. Have him killed off camera and move ahead. But yeah, they just said, never mind. All those post-credit scenes, just ignore them.
Yeah, who cares?
We were kidding.
The last 5 years of movies that we've been building with are just whatever. We screwed up. Maybe there'll be like a line in Secret Wars. The Avengers one in the movie world, they'll be like, oh, it's eliminated all these universes. Even, look, this one, all these Kangs.
We have to kill all the Kangs.
Yeah, and they'll all be gone. I did read something about the new X-Men movie, though, that has me a little leery, is they said it's going to be very youth-focused film for, they're trying to make it for, like, you directed towards youths also.
Oh.
Which, I understand why, because they want to draw on a younger audience, but I think they just need to realize who their audience is.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, they're not going to draw in this younger audience they want. They're just not going to. And
that's not their IP. They didn't grow up on it, and they don't care.
Yeah, and then they're just going to alienate the people who are going to go see that movie.
Yeah, the ones like us that grew up on X-Men and love them, we just want a good X-Men movie.
Yeah.
And my kids that are, you know, 14 and 18, they don't give a shit.
No, they don't
never have.
Yeah.
And, you know, they give a shit about Five Nights at Freddy's coming out.
Right.
They give a shit about the Minecraft movie. That I don't, and that's great.
Yeah.
They deserve their own IP, not having our IP shoved down their throats.
Right.
And that's kind of what Marvel's doing. Like, let's force feed them something someone else loves, make them love it too. They won't. And we're not gonna love the Minecraft movie in the same way, because that's theirs. That's what they are passionate about. And we saw, I mean, look at how crazy it created pandemonium. My daughter had to go to the theater to see it. And she was filming the kids screaming, yelling, and it's, you know, that's great. That's theirs. I'm glad I can drop her off and not have to experience it.
Yeah.
But X-Men is ours the same way. They have no interest in seeing it. Neither one of them wants to see Fantastic Four.
Yeah,
so
you
have to look at it. But both of them, we were at one of the things we did at Comic-Con, we went to the Five Nights at Freddy's panel, and both of them were squealing at certain things that meant nothing to me.
Right.
And that's good. Let them own their own passions and not be like, hey, no, love what we love, damn it, because I want to be able to watch it with you and not bring.
Yeah, it's tough, man. I mean, they just got to accept who their audience is and start catering to those people and just realize, like, reaching the youth is just not it. Like, they've tried with shows like Miss Marvel and Ironheart and you know, even the Marvels movie, which I didn't hate any of those. I think they were all
entertaining enough,
but like, they also, I realized, like, I watched them with, like, the also the idea in my mind, like, these also weren't made for me. So, like, if I don't super resonate with a story about a 13-year-old Muslim girl struggling to find herself, like, that's probably the correct answer, you know? Like, you know,
but,
like,
can I be entertained? And
I was. Yeah, yeah,
and I know people who just passionately despise it. And do they actually despise it, or are they, you know, reiterating what the internet tells them to say?
It's that one. Yeah, it's that one. So, Well, how let's I do want to ask you too, you know, how your experience was at San Diego Comic-Con, because man, what a cool, I mean, I used to go to the convention every year as a spectator, of course, and it was amazing. I haven't been in more than 20 years now.
Okay.
I think 2003 was probably, 2004 maybe was the last time I went.
Yeah.
So.
And it's grown exponentially since then.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a crazy thing. And this year I went more as a spectator and did a panel. So you got your point where you're kind of putting on the professional hat. But that one, I tell people, because inevitably I walk through Artist Alley and small press, and everybody's telling me, why aren't you here? You need to be set up, because I have done it as an exhibitor, and I did so well. I mean, it was one of those things where I had sold so many books, I had to drive home and get more.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's always a beautiful problem to have.
Yeah, yeah.
And I enjoy it, but after about 2 days, I get that itch. Like, I should be behind a table selling books to people. So I actually found someone who's willing to split with me for next year. So we're going to do a 50-50, because he's in the same place. He wants a couple days to just enjoy, goof around, walk around and let other people sell you their shit. And then also wants a chance to sell his own. So next year I'll be tabling again and splitting it. But the year that I did do it was crazy. It was one of the wildest things, because there are people who will never step foot into small press.
Mm.
You'll never
see
them. They're going to go to Mattel, to Funko, to Hasbro. They're looking to make themselves rich on eBay.
Yeah.
They don't give a shit about comic books in any capacity. And then there are the ones who do purposely step foot into small press, not trying to switch to a bathroom or to get food. And they are eager for new material. They are looking for the new book to love, and they will hear your pitch, and if you sell them on your concept, they will buy it, and most of them will buy everything. Like, okay, I want issues 1 through 10, I want them all. And then they'll be the same ones that might back you on Kickstarter, because I have a lot of backers that were at the San Diego Comic-Con that I worked, and they're backing every time to keep themselves caught up with it. So it's one of those shows that the right crowd will come to you, and the wrong crowd will never come your way. And it's okay.
Yeah.
You don't need them anyway, because they were never going to buy any book, your book, a Marvel book, it doesn't matter. They're there either searching out the autographs or searching for the big high money toys. And that's fine. They have their own part of the room, but those who do kind of do the ups and downs in small press, they're going to buy your book, and they're the ones that are going to end up passionate about it when it's all said and done.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, I can only imagine as an exhibitor what it would be like to do that. So when you say split, are you just going to like split days or split? Uh-huh. So like, you know, somebody do.
We're going to do kind of a 50-50 setup, but at points, if I say, hey, I'm going to be gone for the next 4 hours to do this, he'll be there. He'll know my pitch. And if he needs to disappear, like, hey, I want to go do a panel, I'll be gone for the next couple hours. I'll be there. I'll know his pitch. And we'll just kind of leave our square readers there. So it can be, all right, I can charge for him. He can charge for me. And we can disappear. And we've kind of talked about, we may not do small press. We might actually do the regular floor, and it would cost us the same. And we can do, make kind of an L where his book's here, my book's there.
Yeah.
But that way we can go and enjoy it, because honestly, by the end of Friday, I would have been ready to just be running the table full time.
Yeah, yeah. Because what is it? How many days is it now? Is it Wednesday through Sunday?
Wednesday through Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I think it was just, I think back when I was doing, I think it was still only Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah,
I
don't even think it was for a while.
Yeah. But I mean, there was really, also when I used to go every year, there was really very little beyond comic books. Like, there was some video gaming, but like, it wasn't the type of thing where all the movies and TV show, like AMC didn't have like a thing there or any of that crap. Like, that was it was very,
none of the studios showed up back then.
Yeah
They didn't care. It was comics and toys. I mean, you could always find a huge amount of vintage toys and things like that. You'd have a whole section of the room, but that was it. The comic section, the toy section and then the art section. You'd always have your artist alley where people were selling their original art, and that was pretty much it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even the full convention center. Now yeah, it's the yeah. full convention center and three different hotels. Yeah. And then all of the gas lamp is different pop-ups, and all of Petco Park has turned into something. So it's just
wow. yeah, yeah.
gigantic, where you could not have a ticket and you could be entertained for all of those days just going to all the different pop-ups that are sitting around there.
Yeah, yeah. I used to love going, man. It was some of my greatest memories. I used to go and get a hotel. This is when I get a hotel downtown, fairly inexpensive too, you know, all things considered. And man, I would it would be a grand weekend all around, I will say, in every single yeah. way. I was like my party weekend. I would just cut loose. Then I'd go down to Mexico for a couple days and just hang out in Mexico. It was amazing. So what is a table at San Diego Comic-Con cost now?
Oh gosh, I think the small press is about $700. And then if you want a table, I think it's 12 or 13.
Like in the regular, if you want it in the regular.
Out on the regular floor, yeah. And then there's some of the real, I think that's for a 10 by 10. And the bigger ones can go up to $20,000, where Marvel yeah. Yeah. is set up, where Hasbro set up. Those are $20,000-$30,000 setups.
That's $700 for in the small press, all things considered, for the show, especially 4 days. It's really not that crazy.
No, it's pretty reasonable. And the year that I did do it, I made it. I had my full table paid off within the first 2 days.
Wow.
And you know, if you can do that, you're great. And that, when I did do it, I only had floppies. I can only imagine what I could have done right now with yeah. the trade, with the Cthulhu anthologies as well. I could very reasonably triple my table in those couple of days instead of just make the table in those first 2 days. So yeah, I mean, it's well worth it. And any people that I talk to, they're saying, yeah, it's just doing really well, and they never have to worry about, am I going to make back what I need?
Yeah. How hard is it to get in, to get a table these days?
It's tricky, and I think having the two of us that also have done multiple panels for them, we kind of get a little leg up, and we also do WonderCon, which is owned by the same company.
Yeah, that's so the one in Anaheim? Look at you.
Yeah, if you do WonderCon, you kind of get a leg up to do Comic-Con as well, but we could very well get waitlisted for our first year, and then the next year get in. But here's the thing about the wait list. They'll text you the day before and say, hey, guess what? We have an opening. And both of us being local, we can say, all right, cool.
Yeah,
let's take that opening, because he always does different panels there. And I'm working on putting together a panel about comics and comics for educators. And I think it's one that I could get approved. So if you're already there to do a panel, you've already got your hotel and everything booked. So if they tell you the day before, hey, we just had a table open up, well, cool. I can throw my stuff in the car and I can be there in 1 day.
Yeah.
If
yeah.
you're not local, that doesn't work. Because I was on wait list for C2E2. And about a week before the show, I got, oh, cool, we got you a table. Yeah, that doesn't work when I got to travel, get a hotel.
Yeah, it's a little.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, it's a whole world out there to juggle. And, you know, it's such a weird, that is one of the weirdest things in indie comics that I, you know, when I talk to people about the kind of the financial side and in making it all work, it's like, you're kind of like, yeah, you know, you get the Kickstarter money and you're like, okay, now we can pay for printing and this and that. But also, I don't know about you, but like, I've got, I think, 16 conventions on the books I've paid for right now. So you're like, yeah, that's granted, I get to go to those conventions, but that's also thousands of dollars that are tied up that I can't use for this. And then I have to buy, yeah. you know, and you're like, yeah, it's a weird juggling of where do I put the money and when to make this beast work.
Yeah, I save a specific amount of money every year that's just for the book, nothing else. It's, yeah. you know, it's not for the budget, it's for nothing but paying for the book. And right now, almost every penny of that money that I allotted is tied up in cons that I'm waiting for. And eventually you'll get that back.
Yeah.
But it takes a while, where I was booking cons for September back in February.
Yeah.
And some of them you're booking hotels, you're booking planes, and all of that, you have to wait to get any of it back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it'll come back, but man, you'll, you know, it's an eventually. So it's a weird, it is finding that rhythm of when and where to put it. So, Ed, tell people where, you know, when they should expect Immortal Era 11 to, obviously you got about 19 days left on the Kickstarter as we record this, about 17 as you guys hear this. But once this is over, how long until they see the actual book finished in hand? And also tell them where they can find you on social media and stuff like that.
So for Immortal Era 11, all the principal artwork is done. This week, we're beginning the final lettering. So we do the initial lettering, and then I have my editor take a look at it, and he, you know, makes my letterer lose his mind by changing commas and punctuation and things like that. So with that said, that will be done before the campaign even ends. And since I still have enough money pooled aside to actually prepay for the printing, I'll send it to the printer before the campaign even closes, especially now that it's funded.
Okay.
So what I generally do, and my hope is always, that the moment Kickstarter releases the funds to me, and now I can pay for all the shipping, and I'll probably need to buy some new mailers, I always do. Once I pay for that, when the funds are released, I start shipping the books right away. So I would say about 2 weeks after the campaign closes, I'll be sending out those copies of issue 11 and throwing up the pre-launch page for the one shot that's coming out in October. Because I don't ever want to have a campaign up when people haven't received their stuff from the previous one.
Yeah. That's always a weird, get into a Rob Liefeld situation where you still have people brigade.
Trust me, guys, really, I'll get you your stuff.
Yeah. How old is that campaign where he did that brigade campaign? It's from like 2008, where he still hasn't
still hasn't fulfilled it. Yeah. And I've had plenty. And that's one of the things that makes me want to be quick, is so people know they can trust me.
Right.
They know that I'm not going to be a flake. And digital copies, I don't even wait for funds to clear. You'll have your digital copies the day after the campaign closes.
Yeah.
I send those out right away. So it's one of those things where I want to establish that trust and have people know that you're going to get your books quick. I'm not going to Liefeld you, or like so many creators that I've never seen the book and I know I never will. You know, you're not donating to me. You're pre-ordering a book. That's what the campaign is all about. And if you want to find me on any of the social media, all of it's under Finish Line Comics. That includes Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok. So you can find me on all of those under Finish Line Comics. And now that I'm back from Comic-Con this weekend, I did nothing. From Wednesday through Sunday, I didn't put much on there. Thankfully, Lori was sharing the heck out of my campaign and it got funded during that time. So now I'll get back to sharing new art from the series or from the book as we go. And then also kind of starting to share the first art from the Floaters one shot that's coming out. So lots of art will be posted on those accounts. And yeah, we're start unlocking the stretch goals, because we've already unlocked some stickers and some magnets, and hoping to go beyond that. I haven't even thought about what I'm going to do past 4,000, but I'd love to have to think of something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can send people a digital copy of my book. How about that? You can.
That's good.
So, Ed, I appreciate you being here. I'm excited for you. I know I got, I put in for the, I haven't read your book yet, so I had to start at number one. I am backing the book, so I'll be getting it, guys. You guys should get it. Check it out, and support some indie comics. Support some indie comic love. So, That's it for this week, guys. We're going to get out of here. Again, as for me, go to deescomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network. Live dates are coming at you fast for stand-up comedy. And go to inferno.earth, the website, and the Instagram page for updates on Kill Stand number 3, which will be coming soon. Kickstarter is still live for about 2 more weeks, so we're trying to finish that up strong, get to that goal, and get that out there ASAP. So we're excited to get issue number 3 out to everyone. So so thanks, Ed, appreciate you being here, and for everyone listening, thank you very much for the social. I've been Deese, and we will see you all next week.